Hello, hello, hello. I just wanted to put in a little disclaimer about this particular episode. There are a few tiny bit of little spicy language in there, so if that's something that is an issue for you, just want to give you a heads up. But I think it's gonna be a great episode, so hope that all of you enjoy, and we will talk again soon. Hello, 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 and welcome to the My Empty Hands podcast. I am Reggie Darden, and today I have a very special guest with me, Rob, with the McDojo Life, the man behind McDojoLife.com. Excellent site for exposing the martial arts frauds and crazy people out there, and also really doing a great job with also putting out those that are, the ne'er-do-wells in the martial arts, these fraudulent school owners and these people that commit crimes and whatnot. And they're teaching our children and our loved ones, and they really shouldn't be. So I'm really happy with the work that you're doing and getting that word out there. There's because there isn't a governing body over martial arts schools and their conduct. It's really important to get that word out there about those that aren't doing the right thing. So,
Yeah, for
really
sure.
excited about that.
I appreciate you having me on. I actually just became the vice president of a company called Academy Safe. And so that was made by a guy named Milton, who runs a BJJ or Jiu-Jitsu Dummies podcast. I have been on his show a couple times. And then out of the blue, he calls me and he's like, "Hey, man, I have an idea." And it was an accreditation system for martial arts studios. So not really like a governing body, but more like a way for the consumer to start looking at martial arts schools in a different way. So he hits me up and he starts reading off what he's thinking for credentials. Like, if you meet these criteria, we will certify you as Academy Safe. And it was literally all the things I had been discussing for years. So now I'm the vice president of that. So while we might not be a governing body, we definitely are an accreditation system. And we started like a month ago. So coming up now, hopefully we'll be able to start making bigger leaps and bounds impacts on the industry by accrediting schools with some really standard basic criteria that most any other business would require. So we're not asking much. And schools will be able to do that for free. Obviously, background checks, if they want to do that through us, they can, or they could just do it on their own. Like, however you get your background check, we could care less as long as you do it. And then, of course, we'll still advertise schools, but based on do you have these criteria and ascending order? So oh man, this is an Academy Safe school. They have all the criteria. Well, this school has most of it, but not all of it. So they're not certified, but they still have met these criteria and so on. So we think it'll make a big impact.
Yeah, no, that's going to be huge. I really like that. So all you schools out there, get on that and get certified so that then we know that we're in a safe space to train, and we don't have to worry about these bad actors poisoning us with their bad stuff. So so just to kind of give a little background on my story, I started always being a fan of the martial arts, the black belt theater, kung fu theater back in the day. Always been a big fan of martial arts, but didn't actually get to start formally training until about the mid-90s. I got started in a Kenpo school. It's actually kind of funny in that I always wanted to get involved in martial arts, but my father would never let me. And his story for that, and this is not verified, but he says that he was a bodyguard for Muhammad Ali. And he said that at the time, martial arts was just really starting to get popular in the United States, and he said some of the other guys were around and they were talking about, oh, well, you know, I'm doing this karate thing and I'm going to learn the death touch and I'm going to learn how to, rip a guy's heart out and strangle him with his own belt and that sort of thing. And so that put a really bad taste in my father's mouth about martial arts. So he just, would not let me sign up. But after about 14, 15 years of badgering him and wearing him down, finally let me join the karate school and I did that. So I was involved in Kenpo for, I guess, about 2-3 years. And then I left for the Army. While I was in the Army, I got to do a little bit of Taekwondo, a little bit of Hapkido, a little bit of boxing. Not anything, didn't get to my black belt or anything like that. Just got a little bit of that training. Once I got out of the military, I couldn't find school. I did want to get back into Kenpo, but I didn't really kind of find what I was looking for. So I just kind of did my own thing. And then I stumbled on a couple instantly in love with that. And I've been doing that coming up on 17 years now. Still just, kept my love for Kenpo. And about 2-3 years ago, I found a Kenpo school here that I'm in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Found a school that I liked and been training at that and enjoying that. I always joke that I wish that there was 40 hours in a day because I have this renewed love for the martial arts. Mm-hmm. And I just want to do everything. I've been eyeballing a Kali school. I've been eyeballing another Hapkido school, some Kobudo stuff that I've been looking at as well. And there's just a ton of schools that I just want to go to, but I don't have time to do them all. And, just now adding more to my plate by doing this podcast, it's just not enough time for everything.
Well, that's a good thing. It's good that you were able to, after all that time away from it, be able to be rejuvenated and ready to attack it again. Like my job is really weird because I deal with a lot of the evil in the industry, and I can see why not really anybody else does it, because it sucks. Like it really, for a while there, it put like a bad taste in my mouth for martial arts, which is specifically the reason I started doing what I do, is because I love martial arts. And to go from loving it to absolutely hating it sucked, because I couldn't look at the industry the same after seeing how lackadaisical it was and how it would allow just the most evil people in it. Yeah. So it took me a while to actually really give a damn again. So I've kind of been in the last year or two kind of in my upswing of caring again. Mm-hmm. But for a while there, I was just like, I didn't train, didn't care. I was like, why? I was like, there's no point. And then, of course, I'm looking at this from a different lens when I'm looking at it from the evil of the industry, not the good that it does. And then it's easy to forget sometimes that it does such good, And then, I got to look back and think, well, it gave me an entire career. Mm-hmm. Guided me on a path of doing something that I truly love. And then, I can't let the evils in the industry really dictate how I'm going to view what I enjoy. So I was able to get back into it and start feeling good about it again. But it sucked for a while because every time I'd even think about going to train, I would just be slumped over like I was going to work. No, I was like, this is your job, but that's not your job. That's your hobby. You can go train and enjoy it and not bring this into that. But it was hard to separate the two for a while.
Gotcha. So, I would like to just hear your story of, how you got involved in the martial arts. How was that, your beginning journey, and just kind of tell us how you got started and where you kind of went from there.
Yeah, man. I started when I was 12 because I was getting beat up a lot in school. So around the time I was 11 years old, getting close to my 12th birthday, I got beat up in a gym class. And I was getting in constant fights and picked on and teased in school because I was born with a cleft lip and palate. So kids would pick on me for my scars. I was constantly going through surgeries at that time. So I'd come to school with bandages on my face or stitches. So it was an easy target for low hanging fruit. And one day I got hit in the back with something in gym class. I was like, damn, that didn't feel good. And it was what we call a bee stinger, which is a folded up piece of paper that you put in the shape of a V and put into a rubber band and you snap it at people. And it feels very similar to like a paintball. Like getting hit with a paintball is what it feels like. So I got hit and I turned around and I was like, stop. And then like a group of 5-6 kids stood up and came and sat next to me because our gym class, we had benches in the changing room and the locker room. Mm-hmm. So the class was almost over. Everybody had just changed out. We're waiting for the bell. These kids sat next to me and they were like, what are you going to do if we don't stop? I was like, well, I guess we have to fight. Like, that's how this goes. Like, you hit me, I hit you. That's the way this happens. They were like, all right, well, you can fight all of us when the class is over. And they made it very clear that they were going to jump me after class. I was like, damn it. Like, no. I was like, that's not what I wanted at all. And I didn't even start it. I was just trying not to get abused. So as soon as the bell rang, I walked outside to go to my next class. And of course, they followed through on their promise and they just beat the stew out of me. And they did so for about 5 minutes. And the only reason I know it was 5 minutes was because they beat me from the time the bell rang to the time the next bell rang.
No.
A 5-minute gap, which is a long time to catch a butt whooping. So they were stepping on me. I got hit, stabbed with a pencil. I still have a little lead in my finger from that, or at least the scar of that, which is fun. Nice little reminder. I remember laying there, getting kicked in the face and trying to protect myself as best I could. And I looked up through the little mob that was jumping me, and I saw two teachers stand there and just watch the whole thing. They did nothing. They just watched me get beaten on. And then the next bell rang, that second bell rang, and they all scattered. So I remember laying there just kind of bleeding, like, well, this sucks. And then I saw like a figure coming towards me because my glasses had gotten broken and I can't see a damn thing without my glasses. So I saw something walking towards me. I was like, all right, here we go again. Like, maybe it's round two. And it was a friend of mine. It was actually one of my only friends in middle school. And he was just late to the class. So I was like, oh, thanks, dick. Like, you could have gotten here on time and helped me. But he's always been late to everything, as long as I've known him. So he picks me up and he walks me to the nurse's office. And as he's walking me to the nurse's office, we don't really say much. But he goes, here, you need this. And it was a card for a free trial martial arts class. And I was like, oh. So I put it in my pocket. And when I wound up going home, I asked my mom if that was something I could do. I was like, hey, you know, I'd really like to do this. And my mom was worried throughout my childhood that any sport would cause damage to my surgeries that I had from my cleft lip and palate. So she didn't want me to do baseball because she was worried I'd get hit in the face. She didn't want me to do football, etc. And so when I asked her for that, she said maybe. And I think it probably had a lot more to do with what was going on at that time of me just constantly getting into fights and all that good stuff. And I guess my mom had a viewpoint that most people do about honor, integrity, discipline, respect, all that stuff that typically are the catchwords for martial arts. So then the next month was my birthday, my 12th birthday. I wind up going home, and waiting for me on the kitchen table was a present and a cake. And my mom is a great can bake. So the cake was great. But there was one present. So I opened up the box and it was just a piece of paper in there. And I'm a 12-year-old kid. I'm like, what the hell is this? All I'm going to do is a piece of paper. So she goes, read it. So I looked at the paper and it was a contract for the martial arts studio. She paid in full. And my very first class was on my birthday. My uniform was waiting at the studio. And then I've been doing it ever since. So since that day, it's been 27 years, coming up on 28 in April. Every year on my birthday, I get to celebrate, which is a very easy way to remember when you started. So my birthday now is my celebration of being in the industry for another year. And yeah, I've been able to travel the world doing this. I've been able to teach seminars all over the world. I've been able to teach anti-bully seminars. I've been able to teach stranger danger seminars to kids at local schools here. I've been able to travel and teach like adults kickboxing and nunchucks and jujitsu. And it's been just an awesome, awesome experience because to find a thing that you like to do at such a young age that winds up becoming the thing that you do is so, so rare when I see other people. Most people have no clue what they want to do with their life. They have no clue, no idea. They're in college, they're doing some major or minor that they just can't stand, but they're paying thousands upon thousands of dollars every semester to go learn the thing they don't want to learn. Like, I got lucky. I got to discover the thing that I really like to do at 12 and then just been able to continue to do so my entire life. I've now done martial arts longer than I haven't, which is very cool to me, you know?
Yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure. So do you recall, you know, what that first style was? Are you still in that style? Are you done a few.
I remember the first class. Like, I remember the very first, I remember everything about my first class, which is weird. I started off in a system called American Freestyle Karate, which is a little bit more like a Joe Louis, Bill Wallace, Benny the Jet type martial art. It was a lot more geared towards sparring, a lot more geared towards kickboxing. We didn't do any katas. We just basically worked technique. That was it. And then we applied. It's technique, apply. Technique, well, drill, apply. So we did that a lot. And then during that time, I was learning, beside that art, another art that was taught at the facility was an art called Le Sejo Do, which is a weapon system no one's heard of. But it's a weapon system that basically talks a lot about like angles of attack and how your body mechanics works. So if you learn that system, one perk is that you can pretty much pick up any weapon and they all work the same. Because no matter what's in your hand, the only thing that really changes from weapon to weapon is intent. The angle will always be the same. And then once you start learning those angles and how those angles connect to each other, it becomes very easy to pick up any weapon and use it efficiently. Because you're just basically worrying about these lanes of attack more than you're worried about what the weapon is. So that was super. I'm very grateful to learn that because like I'm one of the few people who know that system, know it very well. And then around that time, I think I started point fighting like a month after. My first point fighting match was a month after I joined. Because my whole goal was I'm just tired of getting my ass whooped. I was like, I'm tired of getting beat up. So I want to apply. The whole reason to do this is, well, I have to know if this really works. So the only way really to do that, yeah, you can spar. But those people are purposely trying not to hurt you, usually. They're trying to guide you and you're trying to work together as a team. A competition's different. That person doesn't know you. They don't care about your well-being. They just want to win. And so that's what a fight is. Someone who doesn't care about your well-being and just wants to win. So wind up doing a tournament a month in. Got the bug. Loved competing at that point because I like the adrenaline dump. And then after that, I went and started boxing at nightclubs at 15. There was a nightclub in town called Plush. And the only reason I was able to go into this 21 and up bar at that time was because my instructor was the promoter for this boxing match, or for these boxing matches that happened every weekend there. Mm-hmm. And my mom signed a waiver every weekend. So I started because it's 21 and up, I had to be the first person to fight usually to start. Like as time went on, like I could just do what I wanted. But first person to fight every time. And then I had to leave immediately after. That was like the deal at first. And then because no one was like helping set the ring up, they were like, hey, we need you to set the ring up for us and we'll let you stay longer. And I was like, okay. And then after that, no one was breaking down the ring and the nightclub people weren't helping. So like the bouncers were like, that's not our problem. That's your problem. So then because no one was really helping break down the ring, he was like, all right, I'll let you stay the entire night if you help break down the ring. And I was like, all right, I'll stay all night as like a kid in high school who is in a nightclub. Like, this is awesome. So I did that for a while. It was called patron boxing. So they let anybody who wanted to sign up that night get into the ring, which is not really legal anymore. It's not the same like it used to be. And then from there, I did kickboxing. Then from there, I was on an international kickboxing team for 2 years called Team Full Circle. So we traveled and really internationally, we went all over and did kickboxing and sport karate tournaments. Then I ran a school for 4 years. And then after that, I wound up getting bought out and became a striking coach and a kids program director for a jiu-jitsu academy in town. And then McDojo Life blew up. And then now that's all I do. So now I get to like travel. I do seminars when I want to do seminars, which I love to do because I do like to teach, but I don't want to live in a dojo, which is what was happening before. I want to teach like kind of like, you know, an uncle, you know, like, hey, let's all hang out for a second. Now get out of my house.
Yeah.
Like that kind of thing. So now I get to like teach and do the part that I like without having to be chained to a dojo, which is what it was like before. I just lived there and I was like, dude, I have no life outside of this, which I think is important for a teacher to have context to life.
Yes.
Like you can't just be like, this is how it is in the real world. Like you only live in this dojo. What are you talking about in the real world? Like you don't have a job. You punch people for money. Like that's not reality. Like you live in the fantasy world. So it was nice to be able to get away from that and live like an actual life. And now I just basically am chained to this room most of the time.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. Kind of going back a little bit, I'm really surprised that your mother was signing off on you fighting, considering her concerns about you, you know, doing not only training, but just doing any kind of sport.
You and me both. Quite a,
that's quite a 180. I mean,
I didn't see that coming either. Like, it was weird. Like, I didn't foresee her letting me do that ever. I remember I remember having the waiver because I talked to my instructor, and I think my instructor didn't expect her to do it either. I think that's why he was so okay with it. I think in his mind, he was like, well, she'll never sign it. Mm-hmm. So I remember asking him if I could fight at the fight nights, because before that I was already a part of like a demo team that they had. And the demo team for the karate school was called the Neon Ninjas. And during that, there was another fight night that was taking place before that. And it wasn't ours. It was at a place called Club 5. And we would go, and my instructor was the referee there, but they did the exact same thing, which is where my instructor got the idea. So we would go there, and we would do like a halftime show, which is like a part of like the payoff for my instructor to be the referee. So we would go as like, just go in literally halfway through. We would do a performance, a martial arts demonstration, and then we would leave. And when I did that, I think I was like 14 when we started doing that. And then I remember like every time I'd go, we'd get to watch a couple fights. So we'd see like one or two fights, and then like we would have to tear down everything and leave immediately. But I remember watching this thing, and this is just the coolest thing ever. The way that it was set up was amazing. I wish more places did it, but you know, obviously with legalities now, it's not the same. But I just remember like the announcer would heckle fighters while they were fighting. And I remember he would heckle people who were like in the crowd. He would goat people into wanting to sign up that night, you know, and that was like his whole shtick. So all night you would hear this announcer just cracking jokes and like trying to get people in the ring. And it was just such a fun environment for what it was. You would think, you know, yeah, it felt rowdy, but Club 5 was not rowdy. When we started Plush was rowdy. Club 5 was like our Five Points area is like our LGBTQ type area. Mm-hmm. So even back then, that's what it still was. And so it wasn't super rowdy. It was like a pretty chill spot, but people would still get in there and box, but it was for fun. Like they would enjoy it. Plush, it was much different. Like it was rowdy over there. Like police, there would be little riots that would break out or like fights in the crowd and stuff. It was a rowdy place. But I just remember going to Club 5 and seeing people get in there and fight. And I was like, I want to do that. Like, I'm already doing competitions. I've been doing this now for 2 years. I was like, I'd like to do something a little more full contact. This would allow me to do so. And it allowed me like a stepping stone. Like, because these are just people. They're just random, regular, everyday people. Most of these people don't train. They're just like drunk and want to fight somebody. So so I remember asking my instructor. He gave me the waiver. He said, hey, if your mom signs off on it. And I remember going home thinking, man, how will she ever say yes to this? And it was like not a hard sell. Like, basically, she was just like, is your instructor going to be there? I was like, yes. And then she was like, is your, my best friend I went everywhere with. She was like, is Joey going to be there? I was like, yes, ma'am. It's like, is his mom going to be there? And I was like, yes, ma'am. Like, because she was. She was like, okay. Signed right off on it. I was like, get the hell out of here. I was like, all right. So it worked out.
Yeah. That is, you know, for any youngish people that may be listening, it was a very different time, you know, 20, 30 years ago. One of my favorite famous stories. So I'm from San Diego, and I stun people when I tell them that when I was in elementary school, we took a field trip, a school sanctioned field trip to Tijuana. You know, Not for any suspicious shows or anything. We were going to the Tijuana Cultural Center, so it was, you know, definitely a legit thing. But I can't even fathom a school trying to convince parents that it's okay to take their children to Tijuana. You know, even when I went, you know, we're on our way back trying to get across the border, and we're on the bus, and there's, you know, people coming up trying to sell us stuff on the bus, and it's like, this is just something we do. So no, nothing to worry about now. So we certainly got away with a lot more back in the day, for good or for bad. Maybe it wasn't the safest this time, but you know, we made it through. So I guess we're doing something right.
So when I tell people the stories of my teenage years of being in that bar, or like going to those nightclubs, or most people have a hard time even believing it. But then I show them like photos and videos. I'm like, look, that you could clearly see that I was there. Like, these are real things that happen. But it's so far out of people's minds now of the realm of possibility that it seems crazy. Mm-hmm. Like, I wrote a book about it last year. Most of my nightclub stuff was from the time I was like 12 when I started martial arts until like I was about probably in my like early 20s, I think. And so that's like what the book covers, is those times and having a, like, basically growing up and trying to still get through high school, like showing up to school. Sometimes I was still covered in blood from the night before because it went from Friday night fights to Super Slam Sundays. And so Sunday was like, okay, well, I still have to go to school tomorrow. And the bell, like, for us to be in our class, I think was like 7 a.m. So being in a nightclub until 3 in the morning, like, because we had to break down the ring. So the nightclub closed at 2. Well, we had to break down the ring. That was at least another hour. And then we had been there all night. So now, like, we needed to get some food because we were starving. And then after that, it's like, all right, well, you got to go to school now. So there'd be Sunday, there'd be days where I would get up to go to, like, I would get up on for Sunday, and then I'd go to the nightclub, which we'd be there probably like 6 p.m., 7 p.m. to help set up and get everything ready. And then I'd be there until 3 in the morning, and then eat breakfast, and then go immediately to school, and then have to go to school all day. So my grades, needless to say, were slipping. So my priorities were not good. So then, you know, it was like trying to figure out how to graduate high school and still do this for a living and, like, try to continue to do both things was very hard. I wind up graduating with a 2.0 exactly. Because if I didn't pass, like, it was a math test. It was the only credit I had left. But it was a math test. If I did not pass that final with a B and an A in the class, I'm sorry, switch that. If I didn't pass my final with a B and graduate or get an A that semester, I was going to fail. Like, I was going to have to repeat high school, which I still have nightmares about. I still have nightmares about being in that, like, that room. And it was like, it's senior year. It's like the last day of school. So the teacher was an asshole and was like, we're just going to have you do this, your final on the last day of school. And of course, no one's there because everyone's already gotten their credits and already done everything they needed to do. So technically, if you wanted to just get through high school, like, you needed like X amount of, you know, your GPA needed to be X. And as long as you got your credits and passed your classes, you're good to go. So most of the kids that last semester were doing nothing. Like, they were just like, they just sit there. They didn't care if they failed. Like, why? I don't need to pass this semester. I'm graduating. We're done. So I didn't have that luxury. I had to be there that last day, and there was only like 3 kids in this room, and we're all have to pass this test. We're all sweating, like, don't talk to me, man. Let me get this done.
Oh my gosh. So my mind works in movie references because I watch way too many movies. And you said that, and I instantly thought of the movie Top Secret. Okay. And there's a scene in there where Val Kilmer's character is he's at school, and he's like freaking out because he runs into somebody else, and it's like, oh, like, you missed, like, how'd you do on the test? And he's like, there was a test, like, I missed the test. And he's like freaking out, and it's like, oh, like, I didn't study. And he's freaking out, and then he wakes up, he realizes he's in a dream, and his reality is he's in a German prison being whipped, and he's like, oh, thank God.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, like, it's weird. Like, sometimes you get like these weird dreams. I get like strange reoccurring dreams from time to time. They're always like the same, like, 3 that like to cycle if I get these reoccurring dreams. And they always like freak me out because they're terrifyingly graphic. And then I wake up and I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot I've had that dream like 50 fucking times. And here I am still having to have this dream.
Yeah, I'm kind of similar. I have this one that's kind of, it's like it's reoccurring. It's what is the word that I'm looking for? It's like continual. I keep having this dream about being back in basic training, but it continues in that, like, every time I have this dream, it's like another time that I'm going back to basic training. So like I've gone to basic training like 17 times. And it's just so weird that every time it's like, oh, like I'm starting over basic training again. Like, what? Man, like I've done this a number of times already. But I don't know where that comes from. My basic training experience was not that bad. I've definitely known some that have had much harder time than me, but I don't know. The brain works in a strange way. The other thing that I've kind of freaked people out with on dreams is that I've died in my dreams, which supposedly you're not supposed to be able to do, but I've done that many, many, many times. Yeah. And then I also dream movies that don't exist. So the kind of weird thing about it is that it's not just, you know, whatever random occurrences, but like a full movie with a score and credits. Like, and I don't know where that comes from. I've always thought that very, very strange.
Yeah, I mean, that's cool. You need to wake up and write that down, man.
I wish I could, but I'm just too lazy for that. So, how did the McDojo life, you know, site, how did all of that kind of get started?
It was just a conversation that I had. I had a class that I was substituting for. Like I said before, after I was done with my own school, I got bought out by a jiu-jitsu academy. So I wound up working for them, and I was a program director. I helped teach kids classes, and I was their striking coach. Like, I literally built their striking program that's still there from, like, the ground up. And now, to look back, it's pretty cool because the guy who now runs their striking program was somebody who was a student of mine, and I taught him his very first class. So it's really cool to pass that kind of stuff on.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done fantastic. He's now a professional MMA fighter. Like, he's doing really well for himself. He signed with the PFL. Super proud of him. So hopefully he continues to have a good career. And we talk still, and, you know, I go train from time to time. And it's always cool to be able to go back and see how well he's doing there. But at the time, I was substituting because I was a program director. So I'm just inputting contracts into the system or making phone calls, all that. And I wind up getting a call from my boss, who never gets sick. And he was like, hey, man, I'm not feeling very well. Will you teach this class? Not a problem. I teach that noon class. And noon classes are funny because it's either people who don't have to work are people who have to go immediately back to work as fast as humanly possible. So most of the people who had taken that class that day didn't have to work. So class is over. We're chit-chatting to each other about random martial arts topics, and the subject of McDojos came up, which McDojo is a term that's been around forever, like well before I ever joined martial arts, even knew martial arts existed. So we got on that topic. But there was a guy there, and it was his first official class. He had done a free trial. He signed up. This is his first real official class as a student, a paying student. So then he winds up kind of listening in on the conversation. Everybody left, but he kind of stayed back, and he pulled me to the side. He goes, hey, man, I'm a little embarrassed. You guys are talking about a McDojo. He goes, I don't know exactly what that is. Could you maybe explain it to me? And so I gave him, at the time, what my best version of that is. And then he goes, why doesn't anybody do anything about that? And I was like, that's a good question. It's just a good question. I had never thought about it, and then kept echoing in my head. I just didn't know the answer. So, of course, when you don't know the answer, you usually want to find out. So I started looking online. I wound up coming across like a website called Bullshido Forums. And Bullshido Forums was a website where it was an open forum where people would just like talk crap about different martial arts, martial artist stuff like that. And I was like, this is on to something, but I noticed like there's no real resolution here. The only goal here is just to talk crap. It's like no one seems to want to be coming up with some kind of solution. No one's truly defined what this is, because like I even looked at, like, back then there was even videos of like, you know, 1,000 ways to know your dojo's love McDojo. I was like, that's a lot. Like, I think we can pigeonhole that a little bit better than what it is. So I started trying to look into what a McDojo is, because the only way to solve a problem is you first have to define the problem, and it has to be a clear definition. So I noticed that most people were complaining about things that were irrelevant. They were complaining about like really semantical things, or they were complaining about subjective things. So they would complain, they would say, all right, well, a McDojo is a school that charges too much. I saw that a lot. Oh, they charge too much. They charge you for all these things. And I was like, well, that seems very subjective to the individual. Like, what's expensive for one person isn't expensive for another. And most of the time, if you can't afford something, you usually wish you could. Like, if I can't afford a Lamborghini, doesn't mean it's too expensive. It means I wish I had enough money to afford a Lamborghini. You know, like, that's typically how it works. So I was looking at that and I was like, well, that can't be the issue. Because I think that martial artists should get paid for what they do. You should make a living doing your job. No other job ever is like, well, getting paid is ridiculous. Like, we don't like getting paid here. But for some reason, martial artists think that that's some virtue. It's not. Like, that is the stupidest shit I've ever. Like, no, it's not. Like, if you want to help more people, make a little bit more money. It's that simple. You can reach more people. You can afford to pay your bills. You don't have to stress as much. You can afford to have more students for free. Like, doing it for free is fine if you want to do that. But you can't sit there and say that you can do it for more people if you do it for free, because you can't. Like, yeah, I have 5 people in my garage. I teach them all for free. That's great, because that studio over there has 1,000 students and 100 of them are training for free because they have the space, the time, and the resources to help more people. And they're not poor. So they're not working another 8-hour job on top of this, which is another 8 hours that you cannot teach more people martial arts. So it's like this thought process that didn't make any sense to me. So I was like, that one's eliminated. Can't say that the price makes a McDojo. And then the next one that I heard was, oh, they got their belt too fast. Oh, they got their belt in like 2 years. So I was like, all right, well, let's look at that from an outside point of view over all martial arts. People, the same people who were saying that people in Taekwondo were getting their belts too fast, were praising BJ Penn for getting his black belt in jiu-jitsu for 3 years. Well, what is it then? So you're saying that these people can't be black belts in under like 15 years, 10 years, whatever the case may be. But you're saying this guy can be? Like, oh, well, he competed. No, no, no. The difference is he does the art you like and they do an art you don't or you don't understand. Because look at how many Taekwondo black belts were UFC belt holders. For anyone just curious, just go look it up. It's astronomical how many, right? Mm-hmm. So we can't say that, well, if they got their belt too fast, because again, that's subjective. Maybe they earned it that fast. Maybe they really are that good in terms of learning that art. Mm-hmm. So we can't sit there and say that it's too fast because that's on an individual basis. So we move forward. Well, the last one that I noticed people were complaining about was skill. Oh, well, they're not very good. Or they suck. It's like, compared to who? Compared to the quadriplegic over there, I think they're doing pretty good. Compared to the guy paralyzed from the neck down, they're doing pretty good. Compared to their, maybe locally, they win all their tournaments. But maybe state, they don't. Well, that's like anybody else. Everyone has a cap. There's always somebody better than you. And if we're going to say that it's based on skill, what does that mean? Are we saying in competition? Are we saying in general? Because if we say in competition, some of the most influential black belts ever to exist did not compete. John Donahue, one of the greatest jiu-jitsu coaches ever, doesn't compete, didn't compete, doesn't do it. But he trained some of the greatest jiu-jitsu competitors ever. So we can't say that is a standard. Well, what about people who impact people? Well, let's see here. How many professional fights did Bruce Lee have? How many fights that we could literally watch? Not stories, not hearsay. How many fights did he have that we could actually watch that he competed in? The answer would be zero because he didn't compete. But he managed to impact millions, if not more, millions of people to love martial arts, to feel like they could do this, and to join. That's impactful. Like, that's important. That holds value. Or how about even things that don't even exist? Ninja Turtles aren't real. The Power Rangers aren't real. But they impacted millions of people, again, to join martial arts. The Karate Kid is just a story. Ralph Macchio sucks ass at fighting. But at the end of the day, he impacted millions of people that want to join martial arts. So at the end, like when we start looking at like what skill is, I would think that it's a skill to give somebody a want and a need and a passion for something. Whether they can kick or punch, who gives a shit? Who cares? No one does. The only people who do are the people who most likely only view martial arts from a combat perspective, because they cannot see outside that bubble that is more than that. Even though those are the same people who will talk mad crap about people who do kata. They'll just talk nonsense about them. Oh, that's ridiculous. Try that in a street fight. Of course, they're not going to do that in a street fight, stupid. That's not what that's for. That's like if I do a push-up, try that in a street fight. That's not what a push-up is for, genius. But anyway, they'll be the same people talking about them, but they'll still line up to watch the Ninja Turtles movie, the live action one, or they'll line up to watch Ip Man, or they'll line up to watch John Wick and forget that all of those people in those movies, those stunt performers, started their careers doing sport karate, doing katas, wound up doing katas all the way until they can move their way into stunt work, did stunt work, and now they're probably stunt people for some of your favorite movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that, it's nonsensical. Like, because the 8711 guys, they're stunt performers. Like, a lot of those guys were sport karate guys. They performed in NASCA, WACO, NBL, stuff like that. They are sport karate guys. So they wind up doing, like, tricking, acrobatic kicking and stuff like that that looks good on the screen. Maybe they can't beat up a pro MMA fighter. Maybe they can, but at the end of the day, that's not what their goal was. But yet, you'll still line up and you'll still pay their salaries while you talk crap about them, which doesn't make any logical sense. If you really didn't like them, stop paying their salaries. Stop watching their movies. Stop going to any action movie ever. Because those stunt performers are made up of a lot of sport karate guys who do acrobatic kicking, who don't fight for a living. So it was all nonsensical to try to define what a McDojo is, because so many people have this weird view. So it all boiled down to, what is the real issue in the industry? Well, I would say that me being able to do stories for the last 11 years, two or three times a week at least, of sex offenders in the industry was a problem. That's a real problem. Rapists and pedophiles in our industry are rampant because there are no regulating bodies. So you can open up a martial arts school and still teach. Like, you can still teach kids even if you are a registered sex offender. That is a fact. In California, as long as you let your boss know that, hey, I'm a registered sex offender, you can still teach kids. Isn't that wild?
That is insane.
So the craziest part about all this is that those glaring issues, the frauds, the cults, the rapists, the people who would purposely hurt their students, the people who would defraud them, like financially, those are all real issues, legally, real problems. But people were so busy complaining about, well, that guy got his black belt in like 2 years. It's not a real McDojo. That's not a real dojo. It's like, you're an idiot. You're an absolute moron if you think how long it takes you to get your black belt is more important than the rapist. Like, and that was what I was seeing. I was seeing no one really talking about this from a point of view that wasn't biased towards an art. Like, just because you can kick, punch, throw, choke, beat people up, no one gives a shit. I can go into any prison in the United States right now and find plenty of people who could beat people up really well. Do you want them teaching your kids? Would you take classes from them? Like, is this really what you want out of this? And most people would say no. Why? Because that guy has a black belt on and that guy's in prison? Like, maybe that guy got out of prison, then decided to start teaching martial arts. But people don't think past that. They don't ask questions like, hey, are you local, federally background checked? Are you CPR first aid certified? Like, these things that you would normally assume aren't required in our industry. Nothing is actually required in our industry. So the goal of McDojo Life then became very clear after taking like a real hard look at the industry, not from a art point of view, but from a point of view of like right and wrong and like what is required of other businesses. And skill, subjective, money, subjective, you know, like, but did you rape somebody? That's pretty black and white. That's pretty easy. I go, yeah, he did. That's it. That's all you need to know. And then you can make your own decisions as a consumer. So it's been a long journey over the last 11 years to really continue to grow, innovate, try to make sure people are aware of the bad gems, but also trying to elevate good gems and trying to show people, like, teach people about the truth. Like, if you're a martial arts school owner and you're not looking at it as a business, it's going to become your hobby again. It's not going to be a business. And then when you start looking at it from a business perspective, you start filling in those holes that really do make you a McDojo. You'll start charging appropriate prices. You'll start having people who work for you who get paid instead of work for you and trade for classes. Like, the people in the industry have these weird thoughts. Like, that's a McDojo. Like, aren't like three of your employees just trading off for classes with you?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what happens if they get hurt? There's like no workman's comp. Like, you don't care about their well-being. What happens if they just don't show up? They don't have to. What happens if like their light bills? They're not going to kick and punch the light bill. They need money to be able to do so. And you think that by not paying them, you're doing some kind of a service. You're taking advantage of these people. That's all there is to it. And you're doing them for a skill that statistically they'll only do for like a year. And if they do it past that, congratulations, that's great. Still doesn't pay their bills.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the day, like, the schools that were calling people McDojos, 9 times out of 10 were the real culprits. Like, even massive schools, like schools that would blow your mind, like Fight Sports, had a rapist there. wind up like letting him go, gave him a $50,000 severance pay. And then when he was running out of the country to get away from his court date, they knew where he was going and still ignored it.
Oh my goodness.
But yeah, but they can choke people real good, so that's okay. Like, no, it's not. Like, that's ridiculous. Or like, you know, like when the Lloyd Irvin stuff was happening and all those rapes were going on, and yet some people still are like, yeah, that's cool. Like, he's good at jiu-jitsu, so that's okay. Like, what are we talking about? Like, I think that it's a weird cult-like mentality when we put these people on pedestals simply because they can punch and kick or choke. Like, and in real life, and outside of that bubble, just apply that to your day-to-day life. No one ever is sitting at a board meeting and going, all right, we have the head of R&D here, we have our vice president, our CFO, we're all going to have a little brainstorm meeting and let's talk about new ideas for the company. All right, cool, Steve, you're, oh, wait, the janitor just came in. He could beat us all up. Let's see what he has to say. Never happened. Not a one time would that ever happen in reality, because that is such a low on the totem pole skill. Is it an important skill? Absolutely. But fighting and swimming are almost identical. Think about it. The skill of fighting and the skill of swimming are almost identical. For instance, if I ask you to swim right now in your house, would that make any goddamn sense? It would make no sense. You'd be like, why? There's literally no water here. Why do I need to swim? Now, the skill of walking would be important if you want to move in your house, but swimming, useless. Fighting, if I ask you to fight right now, it is just as handy. Who are you going to fight? Who are you going to beat up? Why? It's a useless skill right now. But if I take you and drop you in the deep water, you better know how to swim or you're probably going to die. If I take you and drop you into a fight for your life, you better know how to fight or you might die. And they're very similar in that way. But other than that, fairly useless. If I learn how to swim, I will get supplemental things that come with swimming. Probably lose some weight. I'll probably learn about how hard it can be. I'll probably learn about my fortitude as a person. Can I continue to swim even when I'm tired? Can I continue to tread water even when my legs cramp? Can I make it past adversity? Can I compete against other people? Fighting's the same. Can I make it past this adversity? Can I continue to fight when I'm tired? Blah, blah, blah. Will I lose weight doing both? Probably. Can I get a mentor out of doing both? Probably. Those are all options, but they are fairly useless skills until you need them. Then you damn sure better have them. But people make it so that way it's the most important skill. Like, and then I ask them, how many street fights have you been in as an adult? And they're like, well, none. Like, it wasn't that important. Like, you haven't even used the skill. Like, you have to force yourself into using the skill. Mm-hmm. So I think what's more important is, are we safe? Are we enjoying ourselves? Are we getting those supplemental things that come along with it? Are we able to continue to do it with a passion? Is it helping other people? Like, I think these are more important questions than, okay, you knocked someone out yesterday. Who cares? The police care. But other than that, no one else probably cares.
Exactly. All right. So as we kind of head towards close here, I'm still working out my process. So on the normal... on my normal episodes, I have some kind of fun little questions, but since they are primarily focused towards Kenpo, I have to kind of rework them here a little bit. But first one would be a technique or a strike or whatever would be, you know, what would be your favorite technique .
Well, that's easy. I love an axe kick. Axe kick is probably one of my favorites. I've always been kind of lanky and tall, so it's been very handy having longer legs. I've always preferred kicking, which is funny because, like, apparently I'm a better boxer. I was a 6-0 amateur boxer, but a 4-2 amateur kickboxer, so clearly I'm better at boxing. But I've always loved an axe kick. It's especially with, like, people who might not necessarily come from more traditional backgrounds, axe kick isn't usually in their wheelhouse to like to do. So it usually throws them off. They're used to leg kicks or they're used to body kicks. They're, you know, maybe a round kick to the head, but, you know, they're not used to, like, these fancier, like, hook kicks or axe kicks or hinge kicks. These are all, like, things that might be a little more advanced. But I love doing, like, a setting it up with, like, a side kick. You pump the side kick out, you pump the front kick out, because the front kick and the axe kick look very similar. You pump that out, and then once you can get the hand to drop and start defending it, it just, as soon as you pick up your leg like you're going to do it, their hand just drops immediately, and you just throw it up, and it's just the whole foot just smacks right on the face. Mm-hmm. You know, depending on how clean the dojo is, it could be kind of gross, but at the end of the day, one of my favorites. Love an axe kick. I think it's like a fantastic kick that's underutilized.
Yeah, no, I agree. You mentioned you didn't train kata, so I'm going to assume that you don't have a favorite kata or anything.
Nah, the only time I ever did kata was when I was on Team Full Circle. When I was on Team Full Circle, the owner, his name's Tom Kelly, and he owns Tom Kelly Construction, and that construction company actually made all the Fuddruckers. So the restaurant Fuddruckers, like, he built them all. But his daughter was a student of mine, and she wanted to be on a national team. She wound up like going to compete to go to the trials to see if she can get picked up by a team. She didn't get picked up. She did well, but she didn't get picked up. So he was like, I'll make you one. And he was like, if you really want to do this, I was like, we'll do this, but we're doing it my way. And so he built the team. He put it together. I wasn't on the team, I think, for like the first 2 years of its conception. And then I earned my way onto the team. And then I had the opportunity to travel and do quite a bit on that team. But, while I was on that team, the rule was you had to do kata. Like, you had to. Like, he was like, I want triple champions. It's like, my only way I can get triple crown champions is if you all compete in three divisions every time you go to a tournament. Well, there's only so many fighting divisions for your weight class. So if I was lucky, I'd be able to do three fighting divisions. If I was lucky. Like, usually you can do, like, a team fighting, like, for Nazca, Waco, stuff like that. You can usually do, like, your weight class. But that was, and then if I was really lucky, there'd be a continuous kickboxing division, which I excelled at. I did very well in those. But sometimes there wasn't that continuous kickboxing division, or there wasn't that team fighting division. So I had to do kata. And I was like, oh, God, I hate it so much. So, like, I'd go out there and maybe do weapons if I could, which I never did well at. Or I'd do, like, a kata that I was taught by a guy named Drew Derek Bisbee. And Drew Derek Bisbee is fantastic. Probably one of the best traditional kata I'd ever seen in my life. He is multiple time world champion at kata. And he's just some white dude. Like, I remember being like a younger and not understanding kata and stuff like that. Or really knowing what the value of that was. And he would do local katas. And of course he'd clean house because he was so good. But he would do all the yelling and the kias and all that good stuff. And, you know, for somebody who didn't do kata, I just thought it was funny. So I couldn't help but snicker, right? But then I got to know him later, and he's a fantastic martial artist and just a great dude. And the training that he did for it was really hard. So he'd take a piece of tape, and he had like a room with mirrors in it. And like, you'd have this tape, and you had to keep your head under that tape the entire kata. But so you're like in these deep stances. And it like really gave me a lot of respect for that, because that is not easy to do. But you're talking like training a class. You're not doing one kata and you're done. Like, you're doing kata the entire time. So the whole time you're in like these really deep squats. And the whole goal was your head stayed on that level. No matter what was going on, your head was always at that level. You moved your body, kicks, punches, everything. You were always right there. And it was hard. Some of the hardest training I've ever done. So like, gave me a whole new respect for it. And it was not easy to do. And really, it's like shadow boxing. You're kicking and punching the air. This is kicking and punching the air. The only difference is bunkai, which for anyone who doesn't know what bunkai is application. What does this move mean? How does it translate into reality? And that's where it gets a little hazy. That's where I think people fall off. Just because you have people who are talking about certain techniques, like they know this technique is for this. I'm like, no, it's not. It's body mechanics. It could be a billion things. Like, it's not just this one thing. But that's where I think people fall off. They're like, this is a block. Like, that block would never work. Like, of course, that's that person's interpretation. They might be wrong, but like, that's their interpretation. That's the whole point of bunkai, is their interpretation of technique.
Okay, and then my last question there. If there is anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, who would that
be? It's one or two people. Like, they're both alive right now. Very talented martial artists. I got to meet one of them not that long ago for the first time. I'd love to train with Michael Jai White. I'd absolutely love to train with Michael Jai White. He's been around the industry for a long time. Lifelong martial artist. I think, you know, he's got a very like relaxed personality when it comes to all of it, even though he also takes it seriously. You know, if you ever watch Black Dynamite, you'll see what I'm talking about. Like, he is a talented martial artist, but at the same time, he doesn't mind kind of poking fun at it. I think that that's great. That's right up my alley. I got to meet him. He was a super nice guy. Took the time to chat with me. He didn't need to. So that was cool. Arnold Chan, who was another one I'd love to train with, who's also alive. Stunt guy. He's been in a ton of stuff. You know, if anybody ever saw Wild Hogs, he was like one of the guys at the end that fought in Wild Hogs. He's been in a ton of stunt work. But I'd love to train with that guy. Like, he trains all the damn time. And he is very talented, so I'd love to train with him. And then I only had one more. I've never met him, but I love his work ethic. There was a guy named Anis Sharufa, and most people might not even know that name. But if you ever watched the Tron movie that they did, not the original one, but the one that they remade later on down the road, which I guess is a sequel to the original Tron, he is the guy doing a lot of the stunt acrobatic kicking in that movie. And he is probably one of the most talented acrobatic kickers I've ever seen in my life. He flies through the air, and I would love to learn how to do that. So I have a feeling if anybody could teach me how to do it, he'd probably be able to, but those would probably be my top three right now.
Okay. Right on. So yeah, I really thank you for taking the time to have a chat with me. You know, big fan of the site and everything that you're doing. And I certainly wanted to get your story. I do have your book, and
thank you.
I swear I will finish reading it one of these.
I appreciate it. Like, and if you like it, you know, give it a little Amazon review. But for anybody out there who might not know, the book is called Senseis, Bars, and Scars, which is exactly what the book is about, is those three things. So feel free to pick it up on Amazon. Really, you can get it anywhere now. I think you can get it on Walmart.com. You can get it pretty much anywhere.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thank you again for your time. If there anything else that you wanted to throw out there before we close out?
No, we talked about Academy Safe. So if anybody wants to like follow that, and like, it's an upstart organization, it's a non-for-profit. Our entire goal is to try to keep the martial arts industry as safe as possible. So you can check that out at academysafe.org. So definitely check that out. It's a project I've been working on nonstop now since I started as the VP there. So hopefully that'll help the industry stay a little cleaner and hold each other to higher standards.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much.